Hi, Nicholas Vince here. Today on the Chattering Hour, I'm joined by John Philbin. John's been a character actor in Hollywood for over 40 years now, and having worked with greats such as Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves on Point Break, Val Kilmer on Tombstone. And we talk about the fun of making Return of the Living Dead, all that and much more, and surfing. Up next on the Chattering Hour with John Philbin. And we're back with John Philbin. John had a highly successful career on TV and film in the 1980s, working, as I said, on Return of the Living Dead, Children of the Corn, Point Break and Tombstone. And he then segued into teaching surfing to actors, which he did for over 20 years. Let's get to it. John, thank you very much indeed for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure. This afternoon, it's morning for me, though.
Yeah, yes, as the words left my lips, I thought, yeah, that doesn't work for where you are. And you've got lovely bright sunshine, whereas I've got night over here because, you know, the sunset.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had rain yesterday. We're going to have rain tomorrow. And today we have bright sunshine. It's that change of seasons in Los Angeles where we get a little bit of everything except snow.
Right, right. Yeah. We've had snow up north and it's been pretty rough over here. But speaking of California, I mean, you were born in Southern California, is that right?
I was born in Carmel, California, which is considered Northern California. It's up near San Francisco. It's a very beautiful, beautiful artist community type place just above Big Sur. My father had gotten out of the Army. He came from Massachusetts, went to the Army at Fort Ord in Carmel, met my mother. She's from Carmel. And they got married in the Carmel Mission. I've got a picture of it on my wall. And so I my first years as a baby were in Carmel. And my grandfather had a house there that I would go to every summer. So that was the first time I saw people surf in the ocean. I remember the first time I did so many things was in Carmel. And so I go back to Carmel a lot just because I love it. It's beautiful and I feel a connection to it.
Right. So what was a typical day for you as a kid in that case?
Well, I mean, I don't really remember my typical days until I moved down to Southern California, to Los Angeles, which I did when I was in third grade. But if you want to go before, earlier than third grade, I'm happy to talk about it while I still have memories.
So, okay. Well, I mean, either or both,
Well, I'll talk about what kind of informed, you know, my strongest memories as I started to form a personality. I remember, you know, when I was in third grade, so, you know, quite young, I would get the TV guide in black and white and I would circle the horror movies, horror, you know, those were my favorite movies. And I would stay inside on the weekends when I could to watch black and white horror movies. And my parents were not happy about that. I mean, they were like, you know, why don't you go outside and play with your friends and stuff? And I'm like, in looking back at it, I was thinking, these are my friends. You know, I love Frankenstein, the Wolfman, the Invisible Man, the Haunting, just amazing black and white horror movies. The Creature from the Black Lagoon was my first kind of like sexual stimulation horror sex. Whoa, The Creature from the Black Lagoon will always be a favorite of mine. And sometimes I'll imitate him when I swim in a pool, looking up at a pretty girl in a bathing suit. I'll swim sideways with my claws. So, I mean, a typical day was, you know, watching horror movies and then going outside. I had an imagination. I mean, fantasy was my first addiction for sure. I was addicted to fantasy and a lot of it was macabre kind of. I grew up in a kind of sometimes a scary household, and I dealt with it by fantasizing about horror and violence and make believe, you know, catastrophes and things. So I would sometimes go up to the construction sites by the house, and I would build little stick men out of wood and nails. And I would go up to the top floor and I would push them off. And if I got lucky, they would hit something on the way down and lose a limb or something. Or then I would build these models of, you know, the mummy and Frankenstein, and I would build little guillotines and I would chop their heads off. And my parents were like, John, I mean, this is, you've got to find something better to do with your time and your imagination than this. And then around sixth grade, I got into maybe fifth grade, I got into surfing, which is an outdoor bonding, you know, natural experience. And that kind of took over my life from that point on. Surfing became my passion and my obsession, you know, and it still is. I've never quit. I mean, I quit for a couple of years when I was just doing movies and I couldn't afford to travel. And I really just was focused on acting and living in the city. But then, you know, after I had a little success, or I got a little bit of money, I started taking surf trips again, and I've never stopped. And much to the, you know, it was definitely bad for my career, but it was something that meant a lot to my life, my happiness, and it's stayed with me.
Right. So, because you went to, I believe you went to the University of California, Santa Barbara, and you were on the university surf team?
Boy, Nick, that's some research. Yes, I went to UC Santa Barbara. I'm a gaucho. I identify as a gaucho, even though I later went to USC. But yeah, I was on the surf team, because if you were on the surf team, you got a key to a private beach that was pretty cool and a shirt, you know, and I was a pretty good surfer, but not a competitive surfer. I was a pretty good recreational surfer, but competition surfing wasn't my thing. And, you know, I only did that for like a year and a half. And then I transferred to USC and I never tried to surf competitively again until I was old and I got to be on these legend, you know, over 55 surf contests for people that attained some type of celebrity in the surfing world. My celebrity in the surfing world did not come from being a good surfer. It came from being in a couple of surf movies that became part of, you know, the lexicon of surfing. And so I would be invited to the surf contest and I'd have to put a jersey on and surf a heat. And I'm like, I know why I was never a good competition surfer, but it's so much fun for me now that I can still do it. I'm old and I can still get to my feet and surf. And you feel like, God, you just feel like a kid again. You feel really out of shape really fast when you're going out against competitive surfers. They live for it. And that was never my case, but I'm really glad I do it more now than I ever did as a kid.
So what were you studying at university?
Well, when I went to UC Santa Barbara, it was general education. I'd just gotten out of high school. I was doing drama in high school. I was totally into drama in high school, and I did some plays. I was an econ major at UC Santa Barbara, but I quickly discovered that that was not for me. And I had done some plays on the main stage at UC Santa Barbara, and I took an acting class, and I went, that's it. I'm going to change my whole life. I'm going to move to Los Angeles, and I'm going to pursue acting. You know, that's what I want to do. That is my passion. I know what I want. I know I don't want to be an econ major. I can't identify or relate to any of the concepts being taught in the school. And so I just transferred to USC and became a Bachelor of Fine Arts in the acting program and just studied acting for 3 years. I graduated, and then my first movie was Children of the Corn. So I did a couple plays in LA. I got a manager and then an agent, and then I got to, you know, get in couple movies, and it was the greatest thing. It was a dream come true.
Right. So what was your audition like for Children of the Corn?
Well, it was, you know, as I can remember, I was very, I had just booked a film called Grandview USA with Randall Kleiser, and I knew I was going to go and do that, but Children of the Corn was this opportunity that came up. Hey, well, you've got time before you go to Pontiac, Illinois to shoot Grandview USA to do this small horror movie, Children of the Corn. I was like, is that a good idea? My agent's like, yeah, because you should learn how to work in front of the camera with actors. You'll get your SAG card. I mean, you'll get Taft Hartley. Yeah, so it's a horror movie, and that's what kids do. They, you know, if you're lucky, you get into be a horror movie, and this is a Stephen King one. I think it's a good idea. Because I had lofty aspirations. And I was like, cool. So I went to audition, and I was really high on getting my very first job in a movie, which was Scranton, USA, and I hadn't worked on it yet. And so my audition was kind of full of excitement. You know, I had a real wide-eyed, deer in the headlights enthusiasm, and this is I'm having a moment now. And I think that transferred to the casting directors, like, oh, this kid's a perfect for a sacrificial lamb in our horror movie. He's just like, I'm going to kill myself because of someone told me it'd be a good idea. And then it's going to be awesome. And so I think that's how I felt, like, I'm going to be an actor now. And so I just took from my life what was happening to transmit into this kid, this zealot. And they gave me the part, which is, you know, which was just a godsend, because, you know, having had that first experience of a movie set on Children of the Corn before I went to do what I considered a serious film was great for me. And as it turns out, you know, 30 something years later, it's Children of the Corn that is remembered, you know, and I'm still talking about today. And nobody sends me anywhere to meet anybody. And there are no, I don't know that there are any fans of Grandview, USA, even though it was a fantastic movie. It's just that horror supersedes most genres in the film world. And I just didn't know it at the time, but I was pleasantly surprised to find that first movie I ever did has sustained and grown and become a cult movie. And I can still talk about what it was like to be a 23-year-old actor in Hollywood because of it.
What was it like on the set of Children of the Corn?
My scenes were not with the kids so much. You know, my scenes were with the woman that played my wife, and I cut a pentagram in my chest, which I thought was the coolest thing ever. It's like my first thing I ever did as an actor was take my shirt off and have to cut a pentagram with a prop knife into my chest, which I thought was the coolest thing ever. But let me go back to take my shirt off. So I'm 23 and I'm like, oh, I'm not wearing a shirt in this scene. I was on the side, everyone's filming and stuff, and I'm doing push-ups and sit-ups, you know, and like the director's like, God, you do more push-ups and sit-ups than anyone I've ever seen. Like that, you're not like working on your lines or anything, you're just doing push-ups and sit-ups. And I'm like, you don't have your shirt off in the next scene, you know, forever, for the rest of your life. I'm like, push-up, sit-ups, push-ups, sit-ups. And I remember, I remember when I was so proud of that fact, and I remember, I'll get this stuff out of the way, when we went out into the cornfield and I'd already cut the thing and I was going to sacrifice myself, which was really the greatest scene ever, because they had lit the cornfields. It was freezing cold. There's fog. There's all these kids. There's crosses, you know, people are carrying torches. It was very dramatic night scene, you know, with real, you know, all these great actors, Courtney and John. And the costume person had my shirt like this, and I was like, no, let's drape. I want to wear it, because I'd seen Flashdance, and I was like, oh, that's what you do. That's what you do. You put your shirt over here. You know, yeah, I'm a guy, but I was very, you know, fluid in my sexual identity. I'm like, I'm a guy, but I want to show the push-ups and the sit-ups. So I just remember keep trying to get that shirt lower and lower. So funny now to look back on it. But yeah, I had vanity. I had total, you know, body consciousness, you know, as a 23-year-old man actor in Hollywood. It was like, no, this is beefcake. So, but being on the set was great. I was new. I was a novice. It was my first film. I knew I was getting Taft Hartley. I knew my lines, and I used my real life experience of being frightened and having confidence at the same time. Okay. I'm totally off my mind about this thing I'm going to do. So I'm kind of like on drugs, and I'm just working on faith. So I kind of tried to, you know, have that, you know, when you see certain born again Christians or any zealot or any like extremist suicide bomber, you know, this kind of different type of passive, false, confident, security actor, but underneath he's terrified. That's probably how I was as an actor at the time. So that's just what I used. But it was very, very exciting. Fritz Kirsch was a great director, very friendly. I had a scene with Peter Horton. He's just a professional. I'm like, oh, I know that guy. And everybody else was just a kid just blowing my mind with what they were doing. I'm like, look at all these kids, man. We're in a cool movie. It was really fun. It was fun is what it was. And it was good practice.
Right. So you mentioned that, you know, you're still talking about it. It's more than 30 years later, because it was like, 1984, it was released. So we're now coming up to 40 odd. When did you first become aware as to how popular Children of the Corn was going to be, or the genre hit?
I really didn't know how popular it was going to be until I went to a horror convention in Dallas last year, because I never got to be with Courtney Gaines and John Franklin or Fritz Kirsch. I think I saw Courtney on a couple auditions in the '80s, but I never really talked to them or anything. I never went to a Children of the Corn screening. I never went to a Children of the Corn convention, you know, until I went, I was in Dallas last year, and I heard they were going to be there, and I was thrilled because I hadn't seen them or spent any quality time with them. And when I went to see them, the line was out the door to get signatures from them. Like, what? And then, you know, somebody told me how many sequels they'd made. And I'm like, oh my God, this is huge. Cause I was going to conventions for Return of the Living Dead at the time. And I never mixed with, you know, I never saw them at another convention. I was just all about Return of the Living Dead, which was good to me as well for in similar situations. But when I saw their fans, and then I said, hey, can I crash your conversation? You're having a panel. And they're like, yeah, we would love that. And so I got off from my table and I rushed. I was late. You know, they were sitting down there. I went into the auditorium through the back entrance and I sat down, and the auditorium was packed. And the fans were so, and those guys are so funny and nice. And the fans were so appreciative. I was like, oh my God, this is a real love fest here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've talked to Courtney, it's like, both Courtney.
I hadn't seen it personally.
Right.
Yeah. They're so lovely.
Yeah.
And they're so smart and cool. And I was like, look at these cool guys. It's like, I wanted to be part of that family. I wanted to be part of the team. To appreciate it. It's really a great cycle when you do a movie and 30, 40 years go by and you meet people that are fans of it, and then you see the actors you worked with. It's really quite surreal and wonderful.
Yeah. 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 Well, you mentioned Return of the Living Dead, so which you must have shot not long after Children of the Corn, because that came out in 85.
Yeah. A year later, maybe a year and a half later, another horror movie. SAG was on strike. It was a summer in Los Angeles. We got in under the, we were allowed to, we got the, I auditioned for the job like 7 times with Dan O'Bannon and all the different cast members. It was really good audition process. Doesn't happen very often. Almost like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to compare it. Just we read over and over and over and over again with the different members of the cast doing different scenes. He really took his time in the audition process. And then there was a strike. It might've been a writer's strike. I don't know. It was a strike that shut down production. We got in under the wire. So James Cameron was like, we're working. We're very fortunate. Let's have a great time. And again, I didn't get to work with the older actors in that movie. I just worked with my group of punk rock kids. And I really didn't understand what was going on. I mean, Dan O'Bannon had a vision for a comedy zombie movie with punk rock. And I'm like, this music's great. Is this a comedy? I wasn't 100%. None of my parts are supposed to be, you know, I'm like a clown in it. I play a clown in it, but I'm not, you know, I didn't think the situations were funny, which is good. I mean, you wouldn't want to pretend, not be scared of the zombies that are coming at you because it's a comedy. He just mixed some great things. You know, he had me, I had no idea it was going to be what it was. And I'm so proud that I got, and so lucky that I got to be a part of that experience, because even though after the first scene, we run through the rain, which means for the rest of the film, a PA is dousing you with water with a cold hose or a bucket. Here you go. You ready? We're going to shoot this next scene. You know, it's nighttime. Well, I'm going to douse you with water now. That's just such a funny actor saying, oh, the poor actor gets covered in cold water. But that's actors. You know, it's surprising how many actors have to work. If they get wet in the first scene, how they have to spend the rest of the film fucking freezing. I think they should make a book about it or a movie about it, or talk to all the whining actors about it. But anyway, it was super, super exciting. Again, I had no idea. I have a small part that's separated from the main group. And then when it comes out, I'm like, holy shit, is that what you guys were doing this whole time? Because I'm like, I'm not going to the set and watching other people work. I started doing that later as an actor, but back then I wasn't, you know, I was just focused on my little stuff. I didn't, you know, get involved in the drama or watching other scenes, trying to figure out the tone. I just did my thing. And it was right.
Where was Return of the Living Dead shot?
We shot it in LA, in and around LA. We were downtown. We were in a Sylmar. We were in a studio in Burbank, a lot of time in a studio that they'd built, which is great. You know, we're in a studio with different sets. That was fun, a little green room where you're chilling out. And whereas Children of Corn was all location on Sioux City, Iowa. So you're in a hotel and then you get driven in a van to the set. But Return of the Living Dead is shot in LA. So you're driving yourself to the different locations, if they're outdoors or if they're in this, in our little studio that we created rooms in. You know, that's a totally different way of working. It's just different, location versus local. And Return of the Living Dead was in LA, and all LA actors. And I made good friends with like Brian Peck and some Tommy Matthews, who are other LA actors that I got to, like, let's carpool, or, you know, what are you doing after this? And so that was another cool, different experience, because everyone's going to their own home. We're not going to a hotel, and like, you want to go get a drink, you know, like, what are we going to do now? You know, like, are you working tomorrow? That kind of thing that happens on location.
Right. Were you kind of aware of zombie movies? You mentioned the fact that you watched a lot of black and white films when you were a kid, but were you aware of zombie movies as a genre, like George Romero's stuff?
George Romero's movie, you know, I was a little bit older when that came out. I mean, I wasn't a kid anymore. I was into other things and different types of acting, but that movie just terrified me. And I was like, this is a whole new level of scary shit going on here. These monsters are the people, and these survivors are normal people fighting off their friends and family members and strangers that want to eat them. And it was, you know, a whole new classification to me. You know, I don't remember watching zombie movies when I was a child growing up. It was like there was a monster, a created monster, and he was an other, and then there was the whole town or everybody else trying to defeat them. And so it's like I would kind of always sympathize with the monster in those movies. I would relate and identify with the monster in those movies. I would kind of root for the monster. But with this new zombie thing, I wasn't rooting for the monster anymore. I was rooting for humanity, you know, to survive. And that was a new feeling for me to start identifying, you know, not with the monster. Right. When I was a child, I loved to identify with the monster, with the creature, with Frankenstein. I just loved him, you know. The Invisible Man was kind of harsh. But then they made a bunch of movies in the 70s and 80s where the heroes are unlikable, horrible gangster movies. These guys are monsters. Al Pacino, Don Corleone, they're monsters. They kill people. They're sociopathic. They're evil living amongst us, you know, but they're evil monsters. And I didn't have a problem like following monsters that weren't necessarily likable. There was something about them that was, I could identify with. But zombies, I cannot identify. I can't identify with a zombie. It's a new thought for me. It just crossed my mind. It was a good question.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I didn't try. I mean, I recognize a lot of what you're saying, as I've mentioned on the show in previous episodes. I had a very similar experience to you growing up. I used to create the Aurora famous monsters of Filmland model kits, yeah. Frankenstein, etc. Yeah, because they're the good guys. You know, they're the victims. The Frankenstein creature didn't ask to be born. Phantom of the Opera didn't ask to be ugly or be scarred, depending on which version you're looking at.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I feel the same way. Yeah. And now I love our old monsters.
They're absolutely.
I don't know if you had this. Oh, go ahead. You have a
question. No. You were saying.
I don't know if you had this this experience where in acting school, I'm one of those overtrained, underemployed LA actors that hates to work and just would rather go surfing. But we had so many classes that one of the exercises to become an actor, you know, in school was to play a monster, was to transform yourself physically into a monster through muscle, kind of muscle contortion, and then to experience, look through the eyes of a monster, and you fucking love the monster every time. I mean, you just feel sorry for the monster who has to want things through this horrible body he's trapped in, but you know, he's got human characteristics, and to play the monster, you can't help but love the monster. And I would see other people transform into, and I would go, oh, I feel sorry for that monster. I love that monster. Yeah. So identifying with the monster is truly a part of my life for sure.
Yeah. Well,
does that make us different from others, or do other people identify with the monster, or is that just the whole world?
I don't know. I suspect a lot of people do. And I was about to say, I don't remember ever at drama school ever having a lesson to play a monster per se. I remember being given a cardboard box and in a mime class being told to create a creature. We weren't allowed to amend the card. We weren't allowed to draw on the cardboard box or anything. We just had to create a creature like that. But I do remember one lesson that we had where the teacher called Bob Bogue, applied sticking plaster to our faces. And he taped from the middle of my nose, the middle of my forehead, to do that. Oh. And it's such a simple thing to do. And he just said, okay, now, and we were interviewing each other. So the person who had the sticking plaster on their face, and he did different things to people. So I just remember feeling suddenly incredibly confident, incredibly powerful, and just being fairly convinced that I was in a very dark place. And the girl who was interviewing me was in tears. She said, I can't, you've got to stop. You've got to stop. And it was not like I was, it was just this right. Absolute stillness of being so, yeah.
Yeah, I feel it. Those acting class exercises that get you tapped into some primal feelings are so powerful. Mm. I just felt that exercise totally. I was thinking, oh, the girl started crying, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And you're like calm and powerful, like tapping a source of something that's hard to get to if you're not relaxed or you haven't. I mean, it's just a great thing.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely. Well, I mean, changing tack slightly. I mean, one of the films that I did want to ask you about, and that is something that I assume sprang out of your surfing, and that was Point Break. Mm. How did that come about? How did you get that part?
I had done a surf movie called North Shore for Universal for Randall Kleiser, and I had played a very colorful surfer that made kind of an impression made an impression on the surf world, and it made an impression on the acting world. My friends used to go, oh, there, John, I saw North Shore, because I'm huge in it. The character is huge and colorful, you know, and out there. So, you know, it made of an impression, and I will never know whether my work in that film influenced my casting in Point Break. I don't know. No one ever said, we cast you because of your work in the other surf film, North Shore. No one ever said that. So I don't know why. I know I was trying, I read initially to play, you know, Bodhi, which is the main character surfer, when the movie was at a different studio, and it was one of those brothers. Fuck, this is horrible. And it was different director, different cast. I did not get the part of Bodhi, but I got the part of Nathaniel. It was called Riders on the Storm. And I was like, I got a part in another surf movie. I'm going to surf Pipeline and be a bank robber. And Bullet the Blue Sky was the main. I used to listen to the music and I read the script and go, this is going to be the best thing I've ever done. And then the studio dropped it. It went into turnaround. They dropped the production. It was going to be Charlie Sheen and some other people, but my agent said, it's, you know, that's not happening. They lost the rights, whatever, went into turnaround, whatever that means. And then a year later, I just went off and did little TV movies, bank robbers, whatever, cops. And then a year later, it came back, said, hey, that movie has gone to the script went to a different studio, Largo. they're doing it. They've got a different director. It's a woman director, Catherine Bigelow, and they've cast Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves in the lead. And you're going to play the same part you were cast. They want you to play the same part. They saw the other casting and they want you. And I'm like, I'm going to be in a fucking movie again. This is going to be awesome. Biggest thing I've ever done, you know? And I was like, I want to meet the director. I want to read. You don't have to, John, you don't have to read for it. They're making an offer. And I went, I want to read. And I swear to God, I went in there and almost read myself right out of that role. She was like, I was like, here's a picture of me surfing Pipeline. Here's a picture of me jumping out of an airplane. I was born to play this part. I'm so excited. You know, everything except the acting was just perfect, you know, but I'm not a good reader. I get into the character, you know, on the set with the other actors, just diving into the physical aspects of him. But as a cold reader, I'm like,
Right.
I don't know if I can read myself right out of a job. No, you're perfect for it, John. I know. Watch this. You know, like, but hey, getting that job changed, you know, my life. I had worked with Patrick Swayze before on Grandview USA, the first movie I ever did. And so I had a connection with him. We became dear friends. And then Keanu's just the most amazing guy in the world. You know, like he's the smartest guy in any room he walks into, but he would never let you know it. He's just so cool. And I just loved it. You know, I was a badass in that movie. So I wasn't very friendly and I wasn't very nice and I wasn't very happy. I was just an angry guy. And that's works for me when I'm playing an angry guy, you know, but I made friends that for the rest of my life, even though I was a dickhead, I still made friends and the movie became something, you know. Catherine Bigelow's a visionary Academy Award winning director. She went, Keanu Reeves, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure can be a movie star with a gun standing next to Patrick Swayze, a certified worldwide movie star. He can stand his ground with him and we, and our eyes will go to both equally to both people. He can be a movie star. And she was right.
So it was interesting because I was watching the film again. I saw it when it came out. I remember being very impressed with it. And then I was watching it again today. And it was watching, you mentioned the fact you became friends with Patrick Swayze, who you already knew. But what I was impressed by was the dynamic within the group between, you know, the ex-presidents, the guys on the beach and so on. Did you spend any time kind of getting to know the other actors? Was that part of the process or was it just?
That's all we did. Of course, we're LA actors. Yeah, we just hung out. Patrick was our man. He said, you guys are mine. And we just devoted ourselves to him. I mean, I did anyway. And so did Bo. And James was there's a guy that's a great actor named James LeGros. And he's very independent and strong and professional, you know, and he more so than me or Bo. But Patrick took us under his wing. He would take us skydiving and, you know, he would drive us skydiving. He would drive us to his place in Lake Arrowhead and we'd stay with him and we'd go water skiing. He would talk to us at night on the phone every night. You know, we bonded, you know, I spent all my time with my other buddy, James LeGros, you know, and Bo Jesse was busy. He had something else going on too, but we all surfed together, skydived together, went to Patrick's house together. You know, it was a bonding experience. You know, we didn't really hang out with the other actors, you know, like not at all. We were segregated. You know, we were like, we're these guys. You guys aren't, you know, now, I don't, you know, that was kind of a style of movie making, you know, that happens sometimes when enough actors are like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. But some actors just transcend that whole method thing. And they don't bother with that. They're just, you know, they'll talk to anybody. They'll talk to any other actors on the set. I don't know what their problem is. Traitors. But we weren't. At the time, I wasn't interested in getting to know anybody else. Even though, unfortunately, you know, if you're acting like that in a movie goes by and you don't even get to know, you know, some of the great actors in the movie because, you know, you're just going, I don't want to talk to that guy. He's a fucking dick. He's going to shoot me later in life. I just don't want to have any, like, yeah, you're my friend, right? I don't, you know, I know you. It's just like, fuck you. You know, I want to kill you or you're going to kill me. And it's a weird it's a weird way to live for 10 weeks. And afterwards you're like, oh man, you were great, man. And that's, I loved you in that scene and all these other movies you've done. But we had to forego that because, you know, we wanted to be in, you know, different, separate, like you said, bonded.
Right. Well, yeah, it obviously works. Yeah, worked incredibly well. Another film that you did was Tombstone, with another great cast, you know, another huge production with Val Kilmer, Sam Elliott, Bill Paxton, Powers Booth, etc. What was that experience like?
Nick, I almost dropped that Tombstone bomb just there because Tombstone was another movie where the cowboys stuck with the cowboys and the Earps stuck with the Earps. And even though we only did that as a joke during dailies because we were all allowed to watch dailies. So when dailies would come, we'd all walk in and the Earps would sit over in one side and the cowboys would sit over the other. But it was kind of a joke because I love Sam Elliott and I knew him a little bit and Bill and I knew Kurt Russell, you know, so like we would intermingle with each other. Everybody intermingled except for Val. He had nothing to do with the other actors. He was just focused on Kurt Russell. It's a love story between Val, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp. And they were just bonded. Val didn't want to have anything to do with anyone till the last day. And apparently he was super nice, but I missed that party. I couldn't go to the party, but I was there from the beginning to the end. I was there from the Cole reading when we had Kevin Jarre as the director and the writer. And then we started shooting with Kevin Jarre. And then Kevin Jarre got replaced by George Cosmatos, who's an action film director. And he didn't understand Westerns, but he understood action, you know, and they shortened the screenplay and a lot of actors were upset. Great actors, like you said, because these are great actors that Kevin Jarre got to say yes to his script because the script was so beautiful and deep and long. And they got to sink their teeth into real historic character, Western characters. And they were all really good Western actors, you know, and their parts got cut into an action film. And a lot of them were really upset. And I was like, please don't leave this film. You know, please stick around, you know, like, cause you're the best cast. I would go around and get everyone sign the cast sheet. I was like, that was the best cast I've ever been a part of. I don't know if there's been a movie that's had more brilliant actors in it in one movie than that. And it's a Western. I mean, the women were fantastic. You know, there's like a blonde club of women. It was the weirdest thing. The set designer was insane. Catherine Hardwick, who went on to be a huge director. I mean, it was the costumes, everything about it. The cowboys that were out there helping us wrangle the guns. You think about this tragedy in Santa Fe, you know, with the poor Alec Baldwin. But, you know, we had so many guns. We were shooting so much. And I remember in the OK Corral scene, Val Kilmer, I shoot at him and rear a horse and he shoots me with the shotgun, but I get off a couple rounds out from my revolver under the horse. And I remember he's so clear. We're shooting the OK Corral to be an identical replication of all the historical accounts of it. And we got it down to the shot and the second. We rehearsed it so many times, but he said, hey, you know, when in that last take, I don't know if you noticed this, John, but your gun was pointed right at me. You know, you don't have to point your gun right at me. You just point it a little bit to the side. And he's such a good actor that he's working on so many different levels. Whereas I'm just working at shoot that guy. And, you know, he's like, no, with in movies, when we shoot guns at people, we don't point the gun right at them and shoot ever, you know? And I was like, it was news to me. But I just have mass respect for Val Kilmer. Also, one time I reared the horse in that same exact scene. I reared it a little too hard and the horse went up and over and on his back and fell on his back. It's trained to do this. It didn't get hurt. And then it runs away. And, you know, there's a bunch of wranglers around it. God bless the horse wranglers, man, because I wasn't a great rider, but I had to do galloping out of town with no reins. And like those guys, now I love riding horses, but back then, and I loved riding horses back then too, but you know, they didn't make me feel dumb. You know, they made me feel great and comfortable and confident on a horse, you know, and shooting and practicing shooting the guns. But Val is such a good actor. He works on different, you know, he's got he's got such an awareness of the process when you're filming something. And so we would go and watch dailies. The reason I said that, we'd go and watch dailies. And when Val's work would come on about like him talking to Kurt on his deathbed, he'd just be weeping. And, you know, in between takes, he was half weeping and half sad and half just talking to his wardrobe people and his, you know, his costume people and his set people, because he was lying on ice. And you could see he would be communicating straight into the camera, looking straight into the camera, talking to, you know, the artisans who are his best friends in the movie. And then when he would be filming, he would turn up to Kurt, and he would just have this other level of depth that no other actor had. I mean, he was just mind blowing. And then Kurt Russell, I mean, his son was named Wyatt, you know, he had a son named Wyatt. Kate Hudson wasn't famous yet. He's like, yeah, my daughter's coming to the set. She's 16. I think she wants to be an actress. She's pretty good. You know, and like, she's like this beautiful girl and everyone's like, whoa, we all love her. But he, you know, Goldie would come and he's just a family man and the coolest dude ever. And then Sam Elliott's just fucking, everybody loves Sam Elliott. You know, Sam, talk about a guy that needs to, that, you know, if people see him, they come to him, you know, like, you know, he can't go walking out into public, you know, like the world stops, you know, women pull over, guys are like, they want to talk to him. And he's just a dude, you know, he's the coolest fucking guy. So yeah, being on the set for 12 weeks with those guys was, you know, very similar to Point Break, you know, just like, I can't believe this is my life. You know, this is so cool. And, you know, I had a lot of time off, and Tucson's an excellent city. And I love those actors. Robert Burke played my brother in that movie. Also was in RoboCop. I mean, he's been in a million things, you know, he's a great actor and really hooked into the fire department, you know, New York City. It's just a super overtrained, but highly employed actor, very technical. He was so technical. I was like, wow, this guy's working on another level too. You know, so many technical things with getting, you know, when you have to get shot in a movie. But he was just a god. I love that guy. I really loved everyone in that. Again, weird, you make a movie, I don't know if this was your experience. My experience is, you look, by the end of the movie, unless someone's a total asshole, you love them. You're like, I'm gonna work with you, so I'm gonna be open, like, you know, that way. And then you trust them unless they burn you. And I've never had that experience. So you just love these people afterwards. I have nothing but great things to say about all those actors, you know, and my experience with them.
Right. You mentioned earlier on that, you know, you said you actually prefer to be surfing rather than acting.
Did I say that out loud? Yeah. Is anybody in the industry going to see this? That's my new joke about myself. Overtrained, underemployed Hollywood actor that just hates to work and would rather go surfing. I think that's what my agent thought about me 25 years ago. But right. Anyway, right. I really shouldn't talk about that. But you have a question about that? Yes.
Well, no, because I was wondering, because I kind of identify, you know, I left the business for nearly 20 years to go off and do sensible jobs, you know, and earn money in my case. Yeah. Just work.
Yeah. I need to work at something. I want to work at something.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, you know, and just
to make money.
Get a mortgage and yeah. Have a home and stability and all those things you never have as an actor. Yeah. Do you have any regrets about the way that your career?
Hardest question in my life. Hardest question for me to answer honestly. Such a hard question for me to answer honestly. I'm ambivalent about it, is the best I can do. I have different thoughts about it. One is being unemployed and the rejection from not working as much. I was very lucky when I was young. I was a 20-something-year-old white male actor just come on the scene in Hollywood, where all they were doing is making war films and horror movies and cops and robbers. I worked all the time, you know, almost as much as I wanted to. I would work and it was awesome. It's all I ever wanted to do, but I was immature. And I was spoiled. And I thought, well, this is how it's going to go for the rest of my life. You know, like, I'm just going to go from project to project, you know, and some of them are really good, you know. And then there started to be long stretches in between the project. I'm not getting jobs that I thought, well, I'm going to get this, you know, I'll do this. I wouldn't get it. And I'm like, why didn't I get that movie? And then I developed kind of an attitude like, you know, look, I've worked for Steven Spielberg and Catherine Bigelow. You know, big directors, Academy Award directors have looked at me and said, I want you to be in my next project, you know, and like, and then I would not get a movie that I didn't know anybody in it. And I was naive, and it affected my attitude about auditions and acting. I was like, well, I don't, you know, this isn't fun. This isn't, I don't know. Do I have to change my whole, I'm one of 1,000 guys, you know, like going into an audition, you pull up and there's 1,000 guys that look just like you, better looking, younger, more enthusiastic, and more that, you know, like I said, I'm a bad reader, you know, I'm a method actor. And they're like, and I'm thinking, what do you have? Like, I go to an army thing to play one scene of a guy that's got one arm, you know, like in a soldier thing. And my friend brought me in because he's the lead. I'm like, oh, I'm going to get this. I pull up, there's 100 guys on the street. I'm like, whoa. And a lot of them are missing limbs. And I look to this other actor, I'm like, what do you got to do in LA to get a job now? Cut your arm off? And that's a horrible, horrible attitude thing to say, you know, because there's guys who lost their limbs, you know, like, why would they give it to me? And I just, my whole thing was like, this isn't happening. I'm angry and I'm bitter and I'm not happy and I'm getting depressed and I need to change my life. You know, this is no way to live. What do I love to do? Because I love acting, but I hated auditioning when all I was seeing was rejection as I got later, after I'd had pretty good success later in life, all I'm getting is rejection, thinking, oh, I'm not desirable as an actor anymore. And that just made, you know, when you, it's hard to stay open and my heart open. And I didn't have the ambition also that I think I saw my professional friends had, that all they wanted to be was actors, you know, and they were like, how do I take advantage of this movie to move to the next movie? Whereas I would do a movie and go, oh, I'm in Southeast Asia. I'm going to go to Bali for a month. I'm going to go to China. And I'm gonna go to the Great Wall of China. I would take these vacations. Oh, I'm in Europe. My friend's working in Europe. I'm gonna go to Europe and hang out and just explore Europe. My agent's like, you know, but I don't know that if someone took me aside and said, John, you have to dedicate, you have to want this more than anything else. You have to cultivate your talent, which I was totally into acting class because, like, yeah, you're paying them, but you're working. You know, I love class too much. You know, too much. I was an actor that would go like, well, I can't go on that audition because I have class that day. My agent would be like, you're in class to get these auditions. This is more important. And I was like, no, I don't really see it that way. I was in like a pretentious, arty acting school for professional actors in Los Angeles. And it was such a big part of my life that it almost superseded sometimes work, you know, or audition. If audition didn't seem to merit you know, I'm doing like Cowboy Mouth or a Sam Shepard play with a great actress in class, you know, with like Sean Penn and Nick Cage, Meg Ryan, they're all in the audience. They're in the house. I'm working with them in class. And here's an audition for a TV show that I don't even like. I go, no, I'm going to class. What? I mean, it was just a bizarre mindset. So if I had a smart, wise, career-minded manager or someone, I don't know if they could have talked me into not going on surf trips, to not missing auditions, to changing my attitude when I went, to go, this is what you need to do if you want to do this later in life. Like, I go to work every day. I'm in an office working every day, and you get a small part in a Philippines movie of the week, and then you go to Bali for 2 months. When you come back, you know, like, people are like, yeah, we wanted to see him, but where was he? Oh, he was surfing. You know, now I have a tinge of like, oh, I think I blew it. You know, like I could have been more consistent, but I did not organically have the maturity, the ambition, you know, the dedication to getting work, not the craft, because I was totally into that. But acquiring jobs that would have let me continue working as an actor, you know, maybe I'll never know, right? I mean, I'll never know, but I made the choice. I need to be happy. I'm depressed. I need to, what makes me happy? And I started, you know, teaching surfing because I didn't know how to do anything else. I'm like, what else can I do? I'm an actor who surfs, you know, like what can I do? I don't have any other skills. So, but I started teaching surfing for movies, and that gave me a new career. And I just dove. I was like, fuck yeah, maybe I'll get some acting jobs, but I'll just dig into this work. And I started a company and just worked my ass off physically. You know, I got to the point where I was like, fuck, this is good, healthy. I love it. But you know, this is hard. This is a young man. You know, I did it for 20 years. You know, I just taught surfing all the time. And during that, and it's funny, my father used to go, when are you going to quit this surfing thing? And I'm like, never, you know, never. And I got back into it. And then I ended up teaching it for movies like Blue Crush and other TV shows and stuff. And then I started teaching, you know, using that, like I teach surfing for the movies and I can teach you surfing too. I started a business in Malibu and I got some clients that were really awesome. I got to meet interesting people. I started traveling around the world teaching surfing, and then people would put me in their movies. Go, you know, my surf instructor John gets this line, you know. Fly me out to Hawaii. I do a line in a Helen Hunt movie because I was a surf instructor. I do a little line. I'm like, oh, I'm working as an actor now because I've quit acting and I've become a surf instructor. You know, it's just life is, you never know. You just never know. And I stayed alive, you know, and I stayed healthy. And I'm like, well, when I met Chris Rowe, you know, I had retired from SAG to get my pension because I was working my butt off. I wasn't working as an actor. I didn't have representation or anything like that. I mean, I'll never not love acting, but you know, I had gone, I needed to take care of my mental health, I guess. Maybe I did it for my mental health. And also I needed to make money, mm-hmm. You know, but you know, I think that, you know, it's strange. Like had I not been dedicated so much of my time in life to surfing, would I have had more opportunities as an actor? Yeah, more opportunities, but who knows what would have happened. But I chose to go to travel and to surf, and that became a career for me, and that career turned out bringing me back into acting in a weird roundabout way. People would go, you're the guy from that acting thing, you're teaching, will you be, and you did those little horror, will you be in my horror movie? Will you be in my surf movie? I'm like, yes. Yes, I will. God, did you just go fuzzy or am I losing my eyes?
No, it's me. I went fuzzy. I just realized.
Is it the alcohol? No, wait. Is it that? Or is it our time up? Is that the signal?
No, I was relaxing because I was enjoying listening to you so much. And it's like, yeah, I went fuzzy. It happens every so often. I did, before we move on to the because we're coming to the end of our time together, but...
That went fast, Nick. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. This has been absolutely fascinating. There was one thing I wanted to, because you mentioned teaching about surfing, which you've done for over 20 years. What's the first thing you say to somebody who says, okay, I want to learn to surf. I've never been on a board in my life. It looks fun. I'm probably not in the best of shape. How did, you know, where do I start? What's the first thing you say to people?
You'd have to pay for that information. That is intellectual property. You know, no, I mean, I teach 70-year-old man, you know, who lives, you know, I teach people seven, you know, all ages, doesn't matter. You know, surfing, it's a safety first thing, but it's just an experience that should be enjoyed and not denied to anyone because they don't live by the ocean or they're not 15 years old. You know, anybody can get in the ocean if they can be taken care of. You know, anybody can experience what it's like to catch and ride a wave, you know, with the right equipment and the right instruction, you know. And I let them know it doesn't matter how old you are, what kind of shape you're in. I can get you into the water and you can experience it. The rush and the excitement and the thrill and the health factor benefits of being, you know, in the ocean where waves are breaking. And don't worry about any of that stuff. We'll just take it, you know, every situation is different. It's fluid and we'll work it out. You'll have fun no matter what happens. Doesn't matter. You know, you just don't want to get hurt, you know, but once the lessons start, once money has changed hands, it becomes, most important thing is you need to protect your head. But that that's not a difficult task that can be done, but I would never want someone I'm teaching to get hurt, you know, like, so safety comes first, but it's fun no matter what, and anybody can do it.
Right. Oh, well, this, yeah, it sounds great fun. Right.
Even you.
Say again?
Even you.
I don't know. I know how dodgy my knees are. What is, you know, we talk about acting and doing stuff recently. You mentioned before we started the conversation that one of your most recent projects was a thing called Undateable John, which was released in 2019. Tell me a little bit about that before.
Okay, that's the last, you know, I was a lead in a movie, that's one of those examples of kind of my life. I wrestled with alcoholism and addiction after I stopped working as an actor. You get so excited as an actor, you're so used to these rushes, you know, and then when they disappeared, I kind of like fell into drug addiction and alcoholism, and then I got sober. And I was like, fuck, that's no way to live, and I got sober and stopped using drugs, and I'll start showing up in places, you know, clear and clean and healthy. And someone just said, you're sober? And I'm like, yeah. And you were an actor. I really like some of your old work. Would you be in my little short film? It's based on my experience. And I'm like, yeah, of course I would love to, you know, it's one of those things where you just stay alive and you show up and someone goes, hey, you want to be in my movie? And I thought it was a little movie. And we worked on the script, me and Sin Posner worked on this script. I just gave her all my experience. I said, hey, is this based on a real guy and a real experience? She said, yeah, you know the guy. And I said, I'm not going to play that guy. I'm not going to play a friend of mine. I've known him longer than I've known you about your bad dating experience with him. You know, you're calling him Undateable John. No, I mean, yeah, my name's John. That guy's name was John, but he'll know it's about him, and I'm not playing him. It's not cool. I'll play myself because I've been a bad date. Too many times. Anyway, we worked on the script and she just catered it to me. The guy's a surf instructor. He's struggling to be clean and sober, you know, in and out of rehab and stuff. Broke, which I was, you know, all these things. And I got to bring myself to this movie and it became a full-length feature. I'm like, whoa, she cast Daryl Hannah and Tom Arnold and Joan Jett, you know, and all these great actors. And I'm like, what do you want me for? Why don't you go get Luke Wilson or get a real, she goes, no, John, you are this part. I really want you to, I go, okay, I'll do it. You know, but I'm just going to do it my way, you know, which is comedy. I'm not going to make a serious movie about, you know, that character and that experience. To me, it needs to be a comedy. But anyway, Estella Warren's in it, this beautiful girl, all these people that are sober. I'm like, this is really cool. It's called Undateable John. It's on Amazon Prime. I'm really proud of it. You know, I got to be the lead in a movie for the first time in 20 years. And, I tried to get my dad's like, when's Undateable John coming out? You know, he asked me every week, you know, and you know how independent movies are. It finally comes out and, you know, I sent it to him. And like, he, you know, it was hard for him to watch. You know, like, well, you wanted to see it, you know, because it deals with, you know, addiction and sex and, I think it's funny as shit. A lot of people go, well, that movie was written for you. And it was. And I really have a good time. I hope people see it and like it, but it's not for everybody. It's gray area material. And the tone is this a comedy or is this tragedy? You know, like, so, but that's life. And I had like to have a sense of humor about things.
Right. Okay. I didn't have a chance to check it out before this interview, but I will look forward to finding out more about that.
Fun movie.
Fun movie. I like fun movies. And I also like quite dark comedy as well. So that sounds up my street. Okay, let's finish by doing the luggage. I can't even say it now. The luggage in the crypt question.
Oh, right. Right, the luggage in the crypt.
The luggage in the crypt. Okay, so... Okay. What film might you take with you?
Miller's Crossing, a Coen Brothers movie about gangsters in the Northeast with Albert Finney and Gabrielle Byrne and Marcia Gay Harding. Miller's Crossing, I can't get enough of it.
Albert Finney, amazing, amazing actor. Yeah, yeah. One of my big heroes, Albert Finney, yeah. What about a book?
I don't know, I'm rereading Hamlet right now. That's a pretty good book, but... I guess if I had to take one book, it would probably be War and Peace or The Brothers Karamazov, some deep Russian novel that's just forever and you could get something new out of every page, something really. I love War and Peace, not Anna Karenina because it's just so sad and tragic, but there's some beautiful things in it. But it would definitely be one of those Russian monster novels.
Right, right, right. That sounds very sensible. What yeah. about music? Favorite album?
I love Elvis Costello very much. I mean, I've loved his music forever. I REM's come up with some great ones. Radiohead has come up with some great ones. I might have to take a Radiohead album, maybe because it's just, there's so much going on with Tom York, but I might take I love the Talking Heads. You know, I came up in the 80s new wave music, Talking Heads, Elvis Costello, then it became Radiohead. Do I have to just choose one? Radiohead, OK Computer.
Okay. All right. That sounds like a good choice. What about a piece of visual art, a painting or a statue or a sculpture?
Well, I can't, that's such a great question. People must just go, "Bolo, I can't talk." But I don't know. I don't. This Michael, the David can't. There's a lot of beautiful statues of Greek and, and Roman, Italian statuary that I just love. God, I get to take it with me. I don't know, a painting. I it would have to be one of those beautiful old paintings that have a lot going on. I might have to take that one because that's a painting that me and my friend in a movie did. We did a movie called North Shore that really became.
Oh, right. You mentioned.
And that's a painting of Matt Adler and I, who's my, best friend in a scene that movie became this a highlight in my life. So I'd take that one with me just to remember him and that experience.
Right. Okay. That sounds very good. What about food or drink?
Well, Italian food, I'd probably be spaghetti with, fresh tomatoes, olive oil. Yeah. I mean, I can't get enough of spaghetti.
Right,
spaghetti, fresh tomatoes and fresh cheese and olive oil and salt.
Right, right. And what about anything we've missed? Is there anything is there a luxury, a pair of slippers or a piece of clothing or a piece of, just something you think, this is what I'd want to take with me?
I'd like to take my girlfriend with me, my Annie Burford. I love her. I can't imagine anywhere without her.
Right.
Really
right.
Love with my partner.
Oh, wonderful. Well, that's very, very good to hear. John, thank you very much indeed for sharing all these wonderful stories with me today.
Nick, you're so good at this. I love you. Thank you so much. I look forward to meeting you. I hope I get to see you soon.
My thanks again to John Philbin. What a fascinating guy he is. And I love his choices for the afterlife. A big, thick Russian novel sounds like a great idea. Join me in a couple of weeks when I'll be talking with another guest from the world of horror, thriller, and suspense. And in the meantime, stay safe and well. The Chattering Hour, hosted by Nicholas Vince, is produced by Chris Rowe Management and Tea Time Productions. Producer Chris Rowe, with production support from Manda Rome West. Composer Kevin MacLeod. Copyright Tea Time Productions.